Hey guys, how's it going? My name is Joseph Fordham and this is NPLH In Conversation With, the football podcast that isn't about football, brought to you by NPLH Studio. NPLH is more than a podcast. Once you've hit the follow button, visit nplhmag.com to enjoy online reads, subscribe to our newsletter and browse our collection of magazines, prints and apparel. On to the show. In this episode, I'm speaking with Nathan McVitie. Nathan is a creative strategist across the sports, gaming, music and entertainment spaces. In the football landscape, his fingerprints can be found on the work of well-known brands such as FIFA, MLS, Nike and Adidas, along with leading clubs such as Chelsea, Liverpool and Man City. He's also co-founder and creative director of Where Is Football, one of the most respected independent outlets in the game. But we don't really talk about any of that. Instead, we touch on trauma, its impact on life choices, photography as an outlet, the importance of broadening horizons for the creative process, and his 1971 Datsun 240Z. Yes, mate, how you doing?
Good. I can hear you. I can see you.
I think we're ticking all the boxes this time.
You are a little quiet because I don't want to wear headphones. Like, if I can wear headphones, but it's just like, it's a bit nerdy, so I might not do that.
Street cred dips dramatically.
I know. Well, I haven't shaved. I've got a little bit of a creasy t-shirt on. I'm just going full do it live moment.
You've really come crashing into 2024.
Yeah, I didn't do any resolutions. I didn't do any reflections. I just kind of went for it.
It's a massive win compared to our first effort.
That's a good point.
It's very, very rare that I go into one of these conversations and there's been an interaction before.
Yeah, just, well, that's probably better because you probably get good intro material and stuff too. Yeah. So,
you know what, on that note, just going back to the fact that we've had a brief interaction before when we were just going through some tech issues, I just had another look through your site because I think one thing that I took out of 2023 was, even though the unscripted chats are good, maybe I could do a little bit more background on the people I'm speaking to. So I was like, okay, I'm going to have another look through his work. And I was going through the photography section and we were actually at the same Clapton CFC game back in 2018.
Was it the first game? It was away. Did the guy break his leg? Or whatever it was, there was an ambulance that came.
There's so much has happened in that time. I couldn't really tell you, but I'm like, hang on a minute. It's like Point Break, you know, where he's on the side and the trail's still warm.
It's funny because, like, it's actually, you know, not to pull away from what you just said, but my website is so not updated. Like, there's like three photography things on there. You can't see it, but because I just moved it to clean up, but I have a whole crate of negatives that I need to, I've got them all scanned and everything, but I need to organize them. There's 300 rolls of negatives that I've got to like organize and file away. But on my website, there's like, I think there's Cuba, a Clapton game, maybe Athens. There's like three things, like there's nothing there. So the fact that you found something that you were at in one of the things I decided to upload is the universe probably telling us something.
Yeah, it would have been even madder if I'd have said I was in Greece in 2018.
Yeah, that's true.
Behind the cars.
Or in Cuba. I thought you were going to say Cuba or something. You're in Havana at the same time as me.
If you just zoom in to the shop window, that's me sitting there reading the paper over a coffee.
The other English guy in the corner. It's that Clapton. That's funny. I think if it's the same thing that you're talking about, because I've been going to Clapton games for a while. I think the first one I went to was like 2014 or 15. It was a non-league day. This is back when it was all the fans were still going to Clapton, actual Clapton FC games at the old Spotted Dog. And because we all got together, I didn't play much of a role in it, but I was at the meeting and such. But we all got together to try and start sort of a Phoenix club, sort of a fan-owned team, like outside of the Clapton FC remit because of the owner and such. they're having a good time at the moment, but that was before like some of the legends of like the mid 2010s for Clapton sort of came back to CFC. But yeah, that was like a fun little moment to see them sort of learn the ropes. They're so well organized, a lot of those people that are in like behind the scenes there, you know. It's been a pretty amazing journey to watch. Unfortunately, I moved away halfway through it, you know, but at the same time, like the fact that I can follow a non-league club in London from 6,000 miles away is pretty is it probably more of a testament to them than it is to me.
It does show you what hard work and a bit of community can give you, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're better ran than a lot of teams multiple divisions above them.
Yeah.
You know, there's probably teams in League Two and League One that are not as functional as the volunteers, unpaid volunteers at Clapton are, you know, so.
I can think of a couple a little bit higher up than that as well. That's true. Bit of that organization.
Just the only difference there is there's a bit more money floating around that they can mask the problems with, but yeah.
Absolutely. So touching on that, so you were, I didn't know that you were involved in the early days of that community effort, but then this does tie in with two other projects that you're heavily involved in, Where Is Football and Common Goal.
Yeah.
So this is obviously something that's very important to you.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll come back around to that question, but I think it's worth just touching on something that for the first time in, for the last couple of years, I was working at a company called One Team, which they do a lot of name, image, and likeness rights for players. So in American sports, predominantly American sports, there's player associations, player unions that own the collective name, image, and likeness rights of all the players. And then you can go sell those rights to brands, to companies, to licensees. So I worked for that company for a number of years. And I recently, I got laid off in August, I think it was. There was just a change of direction in that with that company. I was always on the creative marketing, that kind of side. And they're an amazingly successful licensing company. And I think that there was, you know, organizational changes there just for which direction they wanted to go in. So I found myself for the first time in a while, 2 or 3 years, figuring out what to do by myself again. You know, I used to do that quite a lot. I used to have owned companies and owned studios. But as part of that process of sort of being on my own, floating through the world again for the first time in a couple of years, I had to do a bunch of soul searching, these exercises, redo a resume. I hadn't needed a resume in 7 years. So I was doing all these things that, you know, a lot of folks do an amazing job of just keeping current for their whole career. I hadn't needed for a while because I just sort of done my own thing. And as part of that, I was thinking through, you know, what are my values? What do I care about? What do I want to do? What means a lot to me? How do I take these just like random words that spring to mind? How do I mold them into a piece of paper or a Google Doc or whatever it is that I give to people to convince them to pay me money, basically to live my life, to get a job. And some of that was, yeah, figuring out what community means to me, what fandom means to me, how can I blend that with the rat race of finding a job and like roles and responsibilities and achievements and all that. And honestly, the thing that kept coming back to me was community. And it's actually on my little about me page on my thing on my resume, on my CV. Sorry. There will be some words that tell you I'm living in America now when I start speaking.
Great to announce that most of our listeners are now in the US.
Oh, there we go.
The date is in. So you're good.
Well, I'm sure my accent and also some of the words I use will ring true for them. But the exploration of that was all, you know, it all led me back to community. So I have a line on there that's, you know, everything I'm doing, you know, with all of the things I'm good at, or I like to think I'm good at, they're because I want to build, foster, develop community, fandom, but do it in a genuine way. Like, you know, I've come through all of these subcultures my whole life. So that's really what I try to preach when it comes to having a full-time job or a project job or freelance or consult or whatever it is. So, you know, when you're talking about Clapton, and where is football specifically, that was really just, it was recreational. Like, it was never a job or anything. It was just stuff that I loved to do, but it was all built around that. It's all, it's the manifestation of that point around community. I was never the most active person at Clapton. I was really just showing up and drinking cans of beer on the scaffold and the stands. But you know, I went to a few meetings. I was a, when it happened, I was paying member, you know, those kinds of things. But you know, the reason I was attracted to it and the reason I kept going was because of the community that they were building, and it felt like a genuine outlet and representation of a collective. I think that is a pretty, pretty big through line in what I've done, wherever I've been, whatever I've done. Where is football? You touched on that. It's actually a good time, funnily enough, to talk about Where's Football, because we just sort of we go through these peaks and valleys of like activity and not being very active because of life. We're at the top of a hill at the moment, like in a good way. We've recently started to post a little more often. With the three of us, it's myself, my friend Zach Goldman, and my friend Eric Beard, who started the project way back when, back in 2009, when it was called The Football Report. And Where is Football's always been this sort of community focused outlet, sharing the world's game, wherever it is, whoever's playing it, whatever it looks like, whether it's journalism or photography. And that is the perfect, you know, I could go on for 20 minutes talking about, you know, using buzzwords and talking about community, but it's like the perfect representation of football community fandom in one, currently Instagram or website, but you know, in an outlet, if you want to call it that. My way into that was through the non-league team in my hometown. It was through where I grew up in Cumbria and Penrith. There was a team and I took some pictures and sent them to Eric and he posted them up. And then I was making close friends with football fans in America. Eric was living in Boston, I think, at that time. Zach was in LA, and I just sort of came and made friends with these people through the power of Twitter. And then we started working on it together. And Where is Football, to be honest with you, has been going for like, I don't know, 10, 15 years now at this point. And it's just been this through line in football culture online that a lot of people in a lot of our peers, you know, now quite senior in different brands, companies, agencies. And it's always been a good reference, been a good inspiration, a good sort of rudder for a lot of people. We've done a lot of interesting journalism and photography and sharing photos that feel representative of football around the world and, you know, bringing people together. It could be about any sport, but at its core, it's really just about people and stories and the world, you know, and I think that's been the beauty of it. The common goal thing that you mentioned as well, I'm talking a lot about projects, you know, but I think the common goal thing, the first thing I'll say is we often get confused with the Juan Mata common goal, which is not the same thing, I have to say. It, common goal was when I was working at Leicester City, another story, myself, Eric and Zach, who, you know, of Where is Football, we were working on a few different projects, just like freelancing and, you know, consulting on a few different things with different companies. And we basically decided to collectivize that workload and present it as a creative studio. We obviously had a manifesto of sorts between us, you know, to work with specific types of people and on specific projects that morphed a little bit, but basically football projects that meant something to us. And that was really it. It was just like a way to collectivize talent and network and everything else. And we've been lucky enough. We're not actively working on Common Goal anymore. You know, our lives took different roads a few years back, but we worked with a lot of different brands, huge brands, a lot of different people, you know, from Chelsea and Man City and Liverpool to the J League in Japan, Nike and Adidas to MLS and the Galaxy. You know, we branded a football team in California a few years ago. There's, you know, you name it, there's a ton of stuff. And it was just interesting to us. And, you know, it was all built around football and fandom and everything else. So that was really the crux of it, but it was always stuff that we were passionate about, things that reflected the football community, things that we found creatively rewarding. And I think that really just led us to a good place in the end, like, you know, working on things that you care about, being present in projects and with people that form this community, I think is the thing that we can, and that you're also passionate about, is the thing that we can only ever hope to achieve in a long, well-lived life. And the more I do those explorations and thinking value explorations myself to really get a grasp of what I care about, that's the thing that shines through, is why would I waste my time working for somebody who doesn't care? Why would I waste my time working on something that I don't care about? To put it succinctly, I'm going to spend a lot of my energies to try and work and be present with things that bring me joy at the end of the day, or don't feel like work in a lot of ways. I think whether I knew it a lot when I was younger, that was always the thing that I pursued through my kind of winding path. Obviously a lot of people don't have that luxury, you know, that privilege, but, I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of ways that I just made that my goal unwittingly and pursued it at different times and with different amounts of energy. But it has been sort of throwing darts in the dark a lot of the ways. And I've been lucky that a few of them have hit in my best Luke Littler impression, a couple of treble 20s along the way.
Topical. I like it.
Topical, yeah. You can tell when this was recorded.
Yeah. So what you've just described there, like you say, whether you knew it or not, but there was like a tunnel vision, I guess, from an early point. Were there ever points where you're coming off of that path and do you feel the pull when you are? Like, because what you've just said there really resonates with me, because I am spending too much of my time doing things that I don't care about. I've not been at the races all day today. 15 minutes before this kicked off, I felt energized, which tells me that this is something that I should keep doing and that I get a lot of value from. But I've spent 10 hours leading up to this feeling like I could go to bed. I'm that kind of unfulfilled and bored with, and I guess, not respected or even respecting what I'm doing. And so I think there's a bravery to pull away from that in some ways, because like you say, you know, there's, it's not always fruitful. You're throwing darts in the dark, like you say, but I guess you've got to be taking those risks in order to land what you want to land, right?
The short answer is yes, I have felt that pull. But I also, It's really, you need to really take stock that, I said it just before, but somebody listening to this in the future, if they do, hearing me talk about this stuff, they might be in a job they don't like or doing something they're not passionate about. And in those moments, it feels so overwhelming. Like it feels like, oh, this person I don't know telling me, talking on this podcast about just how, you know, they just decided to do it. I don't have that luxury. You know, this person must have money or whatever. You know, it's very easy for it to sound just throwaway and just like, oh yeah, I did this and this and this. But then in the reality of the situation that a lot of different folks have, it's just impossible, or it feels impossible. It feels overwhelming and challenging. And you know, I think in a lot of ways it is. I felt that many times. One thing that I always came back to or used, I didn't know it at the time, through therapy I've figured this out a little bit more, has been to widen the lens a little bit. I think when I'm feeling that, when I have felt that way of overwhelmed, or I can't get out of this sort of spiral, or I don't feel respected, or I don't love my job, or I don't like what I'm working on, or I, you know, maybe I don't have enough money to do the things that will make me feel good or re-energize myself. It's one thing I've always found that's helped, and it's not like a, it's not like a go to the pub and have a drink answer, but it is a, it's a bit more headspacey. It's widened the lens, and I think a little more long term. It's very basic of me to say, but I found that when I've visited these bigger plans and ideas and designs and thoughts and dreams, and I've just broken them down, that's not a revolutionary piece of advice, but when I've done that, it's, I found it to be a lot easier. I remember when I was in Leicester. So I've always, a bit of context here, I've always dreamt about moving to America. When I was, I think when I was 7, I came to America the first time. This was 1996. I flew to America by myself at 7 years old. I had my 8th birthday in July 96 in America, in Chicago, with some family and some distant family that lived in Chicago. And this was like peak Chicago Bulls, Michael Jordan era. But my grandparents, I grew up my grandparents, they dropped me off at Manchester Airport. And apparently I didn't look back at them. I just walked straight onto the plane and didn't even say goodbye, which is a story I heard recently.
See ya.
Sets my life up, right? But I remember hearing that story recently, and it was interesting because I look back on that and I think that the, this kind of pathway to America has been a through line that, you know, it's raised its head at different points. But when I was in Leicester, I was really wanting to move to America. Like I was just like, what's next? I'd left America. I studied in America for a couple of years and dropped out, cause I couldn't afford college in New York anymore. Moved back to England. I was stealing, sorry to my uncle if he hears this for the first time, but I was stealing pound. I was staying with my uncle in London. I was stealing pound coins from his coat pocket to buy noodles at the corner shop because I just had no money. He had to lend me the £15 to get a bus to Leicester for the interview. And I just had nothing. Like I moved back from America, which was my dream. I had to give it up, and then got back to England, and I just didn't know what I wanted to do. It felt like I'd taken a huge step back. I was so close to it, and then I lost it. And I moved to Leicester, and I was in Leicester for a couple of years. And one of the times I remember I was on the phone, I had a long distance relationship with my ex-girlfriend, Alex. I just remember like crying on the phone to Alex at one point. And I was so depressed. I was like, how am I ever going to get out of this town? How am I ever going to get to America? I don't know how I'm going to get a visa. I don't know how I'm going to do any of this. And that was one of those moments where I was just sort of like, that pull was so great, but I couldn't figure out in the moment. It just felt so, I was so defeated. And, you know, it didn't solve itself immediately. I had that low moment for a while, but I found that when I started to make this bigger plan and chop it down, chop it up into smaller pieces, it really did benefit me looking back. I didn't know it at the time. I wasn't present enough in myself, but, you know, you can look back now. I can look back now at the stages of life, and I can say, okay, I went from Leicester to London. I worked a full-time job in London for a year. Then I made a huge leap of faith into freelance design in London, which I had no idea how I was going to pay rent or anything. Did that for 8 months or something. And then I put some money towards a visa, and eventually I got it because of, you know, a bunch of different, you know, things I'd worked on in the past, Leicester included. And I got approved for a visa on the last day, 20 minutes before the deadline, after a request for more information. It was like 90 plus seven. They approved my visa. It was like the last sort of Hail Mary, you know. It was like a Jimmy Glass moment, for those who would know who Jimmy Glass is. Like,
that's for the other 34% of listeners. They'll get that one. The Hail Mary is for the majority. Jimmy Glass for the rest of
it. Yeah, exactly. Well, I was born in Carlisle, so it's a very relevant...
That was pretty neat. Never seen that before.
We're filming this as well, and the video is like doing the little Mac bubbles. I love that. Always interrupts whenever you're in a role. But no, I was born in Carlisle, so the Jimmy Glass moment is something I come back to a lot. But yeah, I got the visa. And, you know, these sort of moments, these pullaways, like these tension moments, I think there's been a lot of them. But it's, in hindsight, I think the sort of the desire to find comfort in my day-to-day has always triumphed. And I think it does for a lot of people. It can be as big or as small as it needs to be. But I think this sort of desire for community, for comfort, for reward, for, you know, you can label that however you want. But I think if you, it's difficult, like it's that's the biggest challenge in life. But I think that there are steps you can take to protect yourself from the outside crap if you need to, whether that is a new job or whether that's simply just like, I don't know, going bowling on a Wednesday night to get away from something. Like whatever that is for you, there is ways that you can surround yourself with that love and that luxury inside yourself. So, you know, I've always done that. And I think, not to get too deep, but I think there is reasons why I am the way I am that I've learned recently. So I never actually said this publicly, but so both my parents passed when I was younger. That's usually something I only tell my friends or whoever in my life, but it's something that I've realized has shaped me a lot more than I thought it did growing up. I never thought about it growing up much, but my mom passed when I was 2, my dad when I was in my early teens. And I grew up with my grandparents on my dad's side in Penrith in England, in small town. I went to boarding school for like 8 years, 8 to 16, on a bursary because we didn't have much money. And boarding school was awful, but good in a lot of other ways too. And I had this sort of my life was decided for me thing all my life. And I'm also an only child. So, you know, a lot of people say that's a good thing, but in a lot of ways, it's not actually a good thing in the end. But so I had this kind of wild, you know, when you look at it objectively, it's a crazy upbringing, like quite traumatic upbringing. Never really was something I thought about ever. But when you sort of put those pieces together now in my mid 30s, and I sort of try to understand who the person I am, how I got to be the person I am, and why I made the decisions I made, you know, I can start to look at little moments in my life, my career, and understand why those happened, right? So the desire to move to America thing. Okay, I could probably say that that was because I was an only child, didn't have parents, wanted to sort of escape where I came from because of, you know, whatever happened to me subconsciously. And I just kind of went after this, I was transfixed on this one thing that would be my own decision and my own achievement. And then things like career, working only in things that I like, sports, whatever else, that you can look at that and be like, oh, okay, well, only child, sort of, my grandparents were a generation removed. They didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know how to support me in like the 90s, early 2000s. So they just like let me do my own thing. Okay. So then I had a computer early. I had games early because I was just like exploring the internet and everything. And I sort of discovered these things I was passionate about and I didn't know anything else. Like I always just thought of was interested in things and I pushed back on things I wasn't interested in because I wasn't, you know, I didn't have to, I was at boarding school and I came home and it was recreation. And I just kind of went after the things I cared about. And then I didn't know anything different. So I just pursued those as a, how can I make that my own thing and a career? So, you know, all that to say, I think because of the journey I've been on through my life, whether I decided it or didn't, I can sort of look at moments along that path and that timeline and understand why I've got to where I've got to. can right now, you know, when it comes down to like what we, where I am and what I'm working on and what I have worked on in recent history, that is a manifestation of that, right? Like this, if something doesn't feel right, I'm going to try my hardest not to do it. Obviously that doesn't always happen. You've got to do things you don't like, but you know, I will try and steer this oil tanker of a life slowly into a direction that feels good for me, that when I wake up in the morning, I can work on something or have a project to work on, whether that's like a consulting thing or a, I don't know, personal project, whatever it is that feels like it means something to me and fits within what I'm passionate about, because then you get paid essentially to do things that you care about. So yeah, big long story, but I think that there's a lot of benefit in trying to make these big things smaller things to work on and understand why people and why you, I'm just speaking from personal experience, why you react this way to things you don't like or you do like. Understanding the whys and hows of it will help you make more informed decisions. And I did that for the first time at 30 something years old. So it's not something I'd ever thought about growing up. But, you know, now I'm here, it allows me to sort of enter a new chapter of life in a more present way, more informed, more directed, sort of efficient, you might want to say, way of life. You know, I can make these decisions with a bit more confidence than I could before.
All through the benefit of some past struggles there. And first of all, thank you for sharing that. I can relate to that only half the way, but I can relate to the impact it can have, but not necessarily being aware of it until down the line. And in some ways, once you kind of go for a period of reprogramming, your thought patterns, I guess, I'm only speaking for myself, but play less of the victim, why did this happen kind of thing, and more of a, okay, what's the value that's come out of that in terms of that I'm not perhaps seeing, you know, and there's like a, there'll be qualities within you that arguably wouldn't have existed had you grown up in the stereotypical nucleus of a family, right? You said something there as well, sorry to cut you off, but you said something about a desire to find comfort. And my initial reaction to that was, it seems like what you're doing is moving away from that. I defaulted to comfort being steady job, regular paycheck, all that stuff's taken care of, and then you just live your life around that anchor, so to speak. But you're seeing comfort in a more holistic sense, in that, and you use the analogy of an oil tanker. So there's a bit of discomfort here that allows me to live the bulk of my life in comfort. And you're referring to comfort as how you spend your time, not in a safety sense, right? That was really interesting.
It's a good little therapy session for me right now, in a good way. I've never really considered it that way, but when you say it like that, it's so clearly laid out. It's so true. For me, you know, the older I get, I will say comfort does sound a lot more like what you're talking about. Steady job, paycheck, especially, you know, when you start thinking, I was laying in bed last night and I realized I'm just about 15 years away from 50. And I was like, well, 15 years ago, I was like just about 20. And so to me, I'm like, oh, wow, that's worrying. You know, I'll blink and I'll be there. So I start to think about retirement and, you know, all these things. And so comfort starts to probably be a little more, I don't want to use the controversial C word of conservative, but like my brain starts to go a little more conservative just in terms of, only in terms of like, how do I save my money a little bit better, you know? And I think that So like in that sense, yes, like comfort is there, but when you said that, it's so true. Like for me, comfort was always passion. And I was talking about this just before, but like waking up and being present and working on things that mean something to me, right? Even if that is not a steady paycheck, the definition of comfort was a little different. Yeah, there's a lot of challenge there. Like you've got to, I think I always used to use the analogy of like, I was eating what I killed, right? Like the, you know, I have to pay my rent. So I have to find something to pay my rent and, you know, everything else. But through the fire, you sort of forge a little bit of strength there. And the comfort definition is an interesting one of like, it feels normal to me, but it might not be normal to somebody who maybe is doing the 9-to-5 thing or whatever it is. Not that that is bad in any way, you know, a lot of people love that and a lot of people get real, real benefit from that for their own journeys. But it's interesting to see it now that for me, I always wanted to be in a place where I felt rewarded or I felt like I was just simply being around and working on things I cared about, because if I'm not caring about it, then what's the point? You know, I can do that for short sprints and short bursts of time, but not over time, you know, really it wouldn't end well for me or whoever I'm working with and for. So I think I never really wanted to go down that road. There's probably some, you know, when I talk to my therapist later this week, I'm sure there's probably some stuff I can talk about there about why I do those things or why I think that way. But it was just always how do I put myself in a position that makes me feel best every day and go through the bad stuff to be able to like get the payoff at the end of it. So yeah, it's a good way of looking at it. It's truth. It is the truth. But you know, you're making this podcast because that feels good to you. You said that earlier on. So
yeah,
this outlet for you is something that maybe begins as a side project, but then manifests into something bigger. I think that's also something that I always did, was like, I'm just going to start a few different little things that make me feel good and see whether they move to and what opportunities they give me and which people it introduces me to. And then from that, you meet more people, you're in more spaces and more places, and more opportunities present themselves, and then you can grab those and then ride that. You know, it's like the big, big old butterfly effect of life. Or I think I always used to say that, use the tree branch analogy, like life is just a series of decisions, right? And if you don't, you go down a path and then you come to a fork, and then you've got to make, maybe there's an infinite number of decisions, but like just for simplicity, there's a left or a right. So you go left, you go down another road, and then there's another fork and you have to left or right. You go right. And you know, you can go on down that ad infinitum or whatever they say. And then suddenly you're like 30 years old and you're trying to figure out what's next. But if you look back, you just made all these little decisions that have been impactful and shaped your journey, like me going to New York to study, or me dropping out and coming back to England, or me deciding at the time, I decided whether I was going to be a graphic designer at Williams F1, which I was interviewing at, or Leicester City. And I chose Leicester City over Williams F1. And anyone who knows F1 or football around 2015, 14 would know that I probably, like, thanks to the universe, made a good decision. And that is just one of those things that I think about in terms of like making decisions that present opportunities to you. So if you started this amazing platform for people, I think the next fork in your road will be an interesting one. Like, what does that get you to? Where does that present an opportunity for you to develop it or move into some other situation? I speaking of comfort, I get a lot of comfort when I think about that. So
a lot of comfort in the unknown. That's really interesting. But then I guess that does take you back to your childhood, I guess. And it's just in you.
I don't ever think of it Like, I would never use that phrase, comfort in the unknown. Like, the idea of an unknown, a void, an abyss is so scary to me. But there is, like, maybe there's a little bit of a subconscious reframing where the unknown is just something that I can form my own thing within that I like, you know? It's just a blank slate. It's sort of like a
Schrodinger's cat.
Blank piece of paper that you can put your own, yeah, drawing on or whatever. The idea of floating through that space uncontrollably is not a nice thought. But if you approach that space with a plan of some description or just an idea even, then, you know, that's a good thing. You can sort of make within it whatever you want to. So, yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point you made there. I'm sorry, more terrifying thinking about the unknown and the endless abyss, or that you are 15 years from 50. What's going to keep you up at
night? I think that definitely the 15 years from 50, because I still feel like I'm 20 years old, and I made a lot of detours in my life, and so that a lot of the people around me are a couple of years younger than me, sometimes doing more impressive things than me. And I have to tell myself or remind myself that I can't compare myself to other people, especially because I'm in a place in Los Angeles where so many people that you come in contact with have these amazing, it's not amazing at all, but they have money, or they have, like, their families have been here for generations or whatever it is. And I've just dropped myself in and I've got to swim hard to stay afloat. So the 15 from 50 thing is like, when I spiral, I'm in this headspace of like, I don't have much time left. Like, I start thinking about, you know, I grew up with a lot of family that was much older than me. In 15 years, I'll be the same age as this person my family was. And I remember the time when I was with them and they had that birthday, or, you know, not to sub story it, but I think about this a lot too, is like, my mom passed when she was 22, I think, and my dad passed when he was like 37. So I'm not far away from being older than both of my parents. Well, obviously older than when my mom passed, but my dad, I think about that too. So, you know, I have all of these thoughts about age that I'm starting to think about, but it feels completely disconnected from how I feel. So I think, like, the scariness of that thought I had last night, I fell asleep straight away, so it obviously didn't bother me that much. But, you know, it's definitely something that is, I can feel it lingering in some sort of very, like, minute way. But I always say that where I am now is the best it's ever been, and I've accomplished so much, and I've got whatever I wanted from life. I've got to reset. When I first moved to America, I was like, I've got to reset my goal. That was my only goal. What do I do now? What do I choose? How do I, like, progress from here? And so when I start thinking about age, it's more of just like, am I running out of time for something? The answer is no. Like, it's your mind playing tricks on you. But at the same time, you talk about comfort, you talk about projects, you talk about age, you talk about goals. And it's just like, what can I do in the time that I have that makes me feel most alive, basically? And so when I'm like, 50 doesn't make a difference, you know, as long as I don't get hit by a car tomorrow, fine. Like, I'll make it there. Yeah. I hope so. But that is a sort of deep thought that you start to have when you start think, you know, when you start to put all of the pieces in the jigsaw. You do the outside first. And once you've started to do the outside, which I feel like I've kind of got a structure now in my life of the outside of the jigsaw, you start to fill in the middle. And when you start to fill in the middle, you start to see the full picture. So when I start to think about, like, 50 years old or something, like, I still feel so young. My age sounds so young on paper, but then I'm just like, oh, well, like, in that short of amount of time, I'll be this age. That's when you start to see the jigsaw fully assembled. And a fully assembled jigsaw, when it comes to your life, is quite a scary thing to some degree, because it feels static and finished and complete, as opposed to, like, changeable and movable. So
yeah, that's a bit of a humbling thought, actually.
It is. It really is.
Strange feeling in my stomach as you were using that analogy.
But there is beauty in that, right? Because it makes you realize it, you can turn that into a catalyst, and you can turn that as another piece of ammunition into what do you want to do? What makes sense? What are you passionate about? What are you comfortable with? What rewards you? For some people that might be, you know, I don't know what it is in England anymore, but being in America, it's like maxing out my 401k retirement account every year. Some people might want to do that. Some people might want to start a business. Some people might want to have a kid, but it just gives you reasoning and conviction for the decisions you make, I find. So, yeah, who knows? I say all these things, and I've been talking about this for, you know, 40 minutes with you or whatever it is, but I don't, this is the most, concrete I ever really, when I talk to others about it, it feels quite well formed in my head, but these are just things that I sort of live minute to minute, hour to hour, day by day. It's not something that I actively think about that often.
Well, that's the best place to be, isn't it?
Maybe that's impulsiveness.
Because that's all we do have is the now, this moment, ultimately. And that's something that I've learned a lot over the past couple of years. And just looping back a little bit to the age thing. And so my dad passed away at 49. And I was told by family all the time how much you're like him, or that you sound like him. And you, as a youngster, it kind of just got drilled into my head that I was so much like him that I had until 49. And instead of that being a catalyst, I carried that through into my 30s, my late 30s, thinking, and it started to almost like paralyze me sometimes with fear, like, oh shit, I'm down to 12 years. And then I wouldn't know what to do. And I wouldn't be like, kind of, maybe that's what I would be like if somebody said to me, you've got 6 months, what are you going to do? Maybe I'll just hide in the room and just be crippled by anxiety. I don't know. But once I kind of hit a bottom a couple of years ago, I was like, oh yeah, I'm not actually him though. And there's nothing to say that I won't get hit by a car tomorrow, like you've just said, or that I couldn't live another 40 years. And once I let that go, stop kicking that can down the road, you do look at things a lot differently.
It's so true. And, you know, I think being able to give the grit, I had a similar-ish thing. I always got told how normal I turned out. So my mom was an addict, and well, my dad, both my parents were addicts. My mom passed from a heroin overdose, and my dad was an alcoholic his whole life. You know, both diseases and unwitting, not something that they ever would have wanted, but everyone always told me how normal I was my whole life. Oh my God, I can't believe how normal you are. You're such a poster child. Like, you did so well, blah, blah, blah. That, in the same way that you were saying about you have till 49 or whatever, or the way that your brain process takes what other people say to you and then morphs it into your own fear or struggle, whatever it is, it's so true. But I think the older I get, the more I'm able to give those people grace in this. They never meant it in the way that I received it or built around it, right? You know, I'm guessing that the comment about your dad and 49 from your family and friends, it was never meant in that way, right? It was just the way that you, through trauma, process and distill that information. And, you know, my side, the same way, it takes a lot to be able to navigate out of that and realize there's self-determination, and you can direct yourself through those things and make your own story. But it takes a lot of, whether it's conscious or subconscious, takes a lot of butting up against the wrong door that's locked before you can kind of emerge as your own person in control of it. So I relate to what you said massively. And it's just another one of those things. Everybody has their own version of that, right? Whether they talk about it or not, whether your parents, plural, whatever it is, have died, whether it's, you know, trauma, whether it's anxiety or whatever, you know, pick something off the never-ending list. Everybody has that, and often it's not talked about. And I think often that because of that reason, I think a lot of people I feel quite lucky. I don't think I did anything special, but I just think there's a bit of a lottery. I think I found my way out of it through happenstance, just complete circumstance. I didn't do anything deliberately to get to a point where I wasn't crippled by it. But a lot of people don't get to that point, or they takes them a lot longer, whatever it is. So I think, yeah, it's difficult. And I think that, it's just being able to give grace to circumstance, to people, to life, find even 1% of acceptance and use that as a way to push forward from, I think is quite an important thing. I sound a little bit like a motivational speaker. I don't mean to. It's like talking this stuff out live is quite interesting from a, like where you got to and where you're at type of situation.
Yeah. And it's valuable, for want of a better word, advice through lived experiences that people can draw on, right?
That advice thing is interesting because, you know, as you progress through a career, you get asked if, you know, about mentorships and advice and talk to people more junior than you and such. It always makes me a little uncomfortable because I still feel that way myself. Still, like, I'm learning. You know, I think the idea of leadership is important, but I think sometimes it's built on a shaky foundation. The idea of thought leaders and leadership and all that. It's absolutely valuable. I'm not dismissing it by any means. And some people are very good at it. Sometimes, maybe this is the sort of like millennial meme in me, but like sometimes I just feel like I'm still in that space of like, I'm learning in life. Why does that make me any better than somebody who's 10 years younger than me? You know, maybe there's some professional things that I've come through that I can imbue, but like at the same time, we might be in the same place, 10, 15 years apart personally. So I think that kind of advice thing always made me feel a little bit uncomfortable. Is too strong of a word, but it made me feel I approached it gently because I'm like, I'm not any better than you. You know, I don't have anything here that is better or worse than what you've been through. But I guess sometimes and people have told me this, like the story that I have or the, you know, the journey I've been on, it's one of 8 billion, but that sometimes I find this with other people too, who have other journeys. Like sometimes you can find a little nugget within that journey that someone can latch onto, and it just puts them in the right frame of mind. And it's, for lack of a better word, inspirational. That saying that about myself, not my intention. It makes me feel very uncomfortable, but, you know, I've had that with other people too. So maybe there is stuff within advice or within whatever else that people can latch onto that's valuable. But I do think sometimes it just needs to be, it lacks the humanity. I think sometimes, I think it's like based in a sort of LinkedIn infographic capitalistic approach versus like we're just all people and we're all humans and we've all got struggles and trauma. Like, let's just try and make our lives a little bit easier for each other in whatever way we can, whether that's at work or at home, you know? So, the advice thing is definitely interesting, but kind of a personal struggle sometimes as well. Yeah.
Just leaning back in to your creative output. I know we've gone off on I'm taking this way off.
Deep tangent.
Yeah, I've taken off. I've kind of got the rope wrapped around our waist and pulling us back out a little bit, but it's just that, but this might come back. I don't know, but you've got 200 rolls of film sat off camera that need filing away. You've got an interest clearly in film photography. Is that something that you found quite early on in life?
Not consistently. I have somewhere photo albums of pictures I've taken, you know, when I was like 6, 7, 8, you know, on film. But the film thing was just the only photos for a long time, right? Yeah. That wasn't film or digital. I remember I got a digital camera really early from a grandfather, one of my granddads. It must have been like 2000, 2000. It was like one of the first digital cameras. It's been there in like little flashes, but photography was never a thing. It was never really something I've been paid for either in my more adult life. I think the short answer is no, but it's definitely been present. I remember when I left boarding school in Cumbria. I went to two boarding schools, 8 to 11, then 11 to 16. And as you know, in England, you can leave school at 16 if you want to. I don't know if that's still the case. I left school and never looked back to some degree.
It's like the airport, but all over again. You didn't even wave at the teachers.
Didn't even wave. I just went, did my own thing. But at 16, I left boarding school because I had long hair and I was listening to music and I was painting my nails black and I didn't fit in. And I was like, I need something else. And I left school and I wanted a new approach. And so I thought, all right, well, I'm going to go to my local school in my hometown because I'd never had that. I'd never had the like, go to school, come home, see your friends, have an evening, blah, blah, blah. It was always like, go to school on a Monday morning at 6 a.m., come back at Friday at 8 p.m. You see people Saturday, Sunday, but you don't have a lot of friends. So I did that. And part of that was I studied photography. It was a little bit of darkroom stuff, but it never stuck. And I left school again, like before I even did my A levels or whatever it was, AS levels or whatever. So I had little flashes of photography, but it's always just been a bit of it's just been something that was interesting or there. And I would, you know, this is being filmed on a digital, like a nice digital camera. It's something that I just learned a skill of early enough and it was there and I took pictures here and there, but it was always a hobby and always has been a hobby. The film thing, it's difficult. I mean, I rediscovered it because my grandfather, who I grew up with in our loft, we had so many cameras. And I turned up on his doorstep as a baby when he was like in his late mid to late 60s. So I was brought up by people with a generation gap. So like my great granddad was born in the 1800s, but he was basically my granddad. I skipped a generation basically on the family tree. And so like in our loft, we had all these cameras that were from the early 1900s and such. And I always found it interesting. And so later in my granddad's life, later in my life, only about 7 or 8 years ago, he wasn't using his cameras anymore. I have 10,000 of his slides from his whole life on the shelf, but they're unscanned. I need to scan them all. He's been to Nepal, K2 base camp, you know, Africa, Egypt, whatever. He's been all over the world, Peru. And I just picked one of his old cameras up that he wasn't using anymore and started using it on a family trip. Bought the cheapest film I could find in this tiny, we went to the Orkney Islands and I just picked up some film from a pharmacy that they had in a town in the middle of nowhere. And it just worked. I just got it. I just knew enough about it that the pictures came out amazing. And from that point, I just kept taking them and it was just an outlet. That's all it was. It wasn't anything deep. I've taken pictures, a couple of small projects here and there I've been paid for, but beyond that, it's just been passion. Some people paint, some people, you know, might do graphic design as an outlet. Graphic design was always a job for me, you know, design versus art. That's the kind of big thing. I was never the best designer and I was never the best artist. There was always people. I was good at thinking about both of them and bringing them together. But for creative outlet, it's one of the ones that I felt able to execute on. And I've found a bit of a creative process within. There's something just unknown about the photography element and just capturing a moment. And then it was just always quite pure to me. And I just captured pictures wherever I went. I've done less of it since COVID, I must say, because for me, my favorite way to take pictures is a place I've never been to before and take photographs when I'm there. Like when I went to Havana for the first time or Russia or wherever it was, I would just snap photographs. That to me is like you're seeing it for the first time through a lens, like that. And then you can revisit that memory. that's a big thing for me. But it was just a personal creative outlet. It was never really a job by any means. It was never a full-time gig, you know, like some of the photographers you've had on here in the past.
Yeah. I just got a whiff of a thread that I thought I'd pull on. That's why I asked, because I guess, yeah, you'd mentioned earlier that you kind of, in a way, just got where you are because of happenstance. But then I kind of just hoped, and I'm always a little bit heartbroken when there's nothing comes out when you pull on a little thread. But I thought, oh, maybe, you know, you mentioned earlier on where is football and how that opened up avenues for you, and you're taking football photographs rather at your local club and all of that kind of thing. And I thought it may have been like one of those stitching it back moments where it wasn't necessarily happenstance. It was kind of just under your nose as a kid that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's definitely true. I think that,
I feel better now.
Yeah. I don't think it was, again, we talked about this earlier on. I don't think it was ever conscious by any means. But I knew how to use a camera, or I knew the fundamentals of it early enough, right? Like I would buy a camera here and there, like whether it was a Canon digital camera, eventually a Fuji digital camera, whatever. And I took enough pictures that I knew the mechanics. So that allowed me to take photos. And then I would, again, when I'm talking about things I'm passionate about and blending them to try and make them something I can do, the photography definitely at one point I was like, I could do this. I could take pictures. I never wanted necessarily to be a photographer, but I had the technical skills to be able to, I know how to take photographs, right? And my sort of, creative background, you understand composition and balance and color and light and all of those things, whether it's graphic design or painting or photography, they're all, you know, they all play a role in each other, right? If you understand light and composition in photography, there's some level of knowing how that works in painting, right? It's very different, but there's some level of transferable skill. So yeah, in photography, it was a bit of like, I'll take some pictures and what else am I going to take pictures of unless it's something that interests me, right? So I took some pictures of football. I did that at a few different non-league games. There's some Clapton pictures, like you said. There's a few different, I took some at non-league day, Penrith, whatever it is, different games. And so I could blend that with where is football. You know, I think that the idea of being a generalist is quite powerful. I think I'm decent at quite a few different things. I'm not, there's a couple of things that I feel like I'm an expert at, but there's a lot of things I feel like I'm okay at. And I think a lot of things that you're okay at, if they're all kind of within the same family, there's a lot of skill like that you level up in one element and it levels up in the other two. They all ladder up into this general kind of, ability. So yeah, a lot of stuff from photography is transferable into other practice too. And I've never been an artist. I'm not an artist. I would like to be. Maybe that's what I'll do when I hit 50 years old. But it's like the idea of pure artistry or design for hire, whatever it is, like the soup of creativity. I went down the path of creativity as a resource for a job, right? Some people go down artistry as an expansion of mind and representation of self. I never fully did that, but as pursuing this sort of creativity as a resource for job and income and whatever else, those types of people often, they need the outlet. They need to turn the tap and let some of the steam out a little bit sometimes. So that's what I do through things like Where Is Football, which has become a bit of a juggernaut in a lot of ways, but still it's an outlet for the three of us. Photography is another one, what have you, you know. I think there's a lot of different outlets that we all have, whether you're creative or not, and being able to like flip between outlets and sort of mainline career stuff is a valuable balance. So photography never became number one as that sort of paid gig thing, but it's allowed me to dip my toes in and out as a release. You know, there's something just that caught me with that about the techie kind of like chemical film, the way that it works, you know, like it's magic and it just kind of happens through chemical reactions and then you can have an image etched forever. Like that's magic to me. And then when you do that 24 times a second, you've got a video. There's just some real special stuff happening there. And like the technology, I love old technology as well. So the idea that you can do that with something that's 80, 90 years old through like springs and motors, all of that working in unison is really fascinating. And then you get something out of it that you've created and like seen and captured and thought of light and blah, blah, blah. So that is like a creative outlet for me for sure. But I'm living in the creative world, the strategy design world.
But all of that, what you've just listed there, that is that key for you to have in your toolbox to exist in the creative strategy world that you do, because you've got the understanding and the interest and the curiosity of all of those elements.
1,000%. Yeah, it's true. Maybe I'm not saying it well, but I mean, that kind of knowledge, you know, it might not be 20,000 hours knowledge that some people have, but, or 10,000 hours, whatever that adage is, but it might not be that many, but being able to talk shop with people in different worlds is something I've always been able to do. I just bought a vintage car because I love old cars. I bought a 1971 Datsun 240Z. And it's a good example of that sort of having knowledge about things to hang. You can hang with people. Like it's being able to talk shop with folks that have knowledge, whether that's like you're on set and you know enough about shooting that you can have you can bring your vision to life because you can have a genuine conversation with the DP, or whatever version of that is the case, right? If you're in the football soccer world, okay, I'm gonna have a conversation with this agent and I know enough about the inner workings of the industry to be able to like stay afloat in this conversation. Or I don't know, sports business, or like I said, with the car, I can talk to enthusiasts and mechanics. I'm still learning a lot, so I can't probably hang out in that conversation as long as I want to yet, but that kind of thing. Or film photography, absolutely. I think that's where I go back to the generalist thing. It's like knowing a little bit about a lot. It's such like a fatherly thing. I feel like a lot of my friends like, hey, my dad knows so many things about so many little things, you know. But whether it's professional or personal, I think being able to learn about things, it's kind of fascinating. I'm not really there's certain things like my granddad, I'm not watching the Discovery Channel for 6 hours a day like my granddad used to on Sky, but I am like, you know, reading the news about the resurgence of Kodak, like retooling film machines and like, I don't know, like on enthusiast Datsun forums that have got posts from like 2001 from people who are rebuilding engines and like, you know, just like diving into human knowledge is kind of fascinating in some way. And then being able to like commit some of that to memory and then pull it out when it needs to. That's what creative people do. You know, if you're coming up with creative ideas, for example, you know, if you're a creative director, or, you know, creative strategist, whatever it is for an agency, if you don't have a wide base of inspiration, you're going to be pulling from the same threads, the same pools of stuff all the time. You got to diversify, whether that's through diversity of thought, upbringing, you know, background, people, or diversity within yourself of like reference and inspiration, like having as many things as possible to be able to pull on and explore will only improve whatever you do. Like that's another theme for my career is, I talk about this actually with my therapist quite often, is I think my superpower, it's not, again, imposter syndrome, not superpower by any means, but the thing that I feel good about with myself is I've jumped between, I've gone from music, I'm going to mess this up. Yeah, music to football, soccer, to gaming, and now I'm dabbling in motorsport. These are all things that I've always found really interesting and passionate about the whole way through my life. But being able to jump between these industries and take what might be more mature, whether that's creatively, from a business sense, whatever it is, and it might be missing in another industry, and bring it into this other industry from an innovation point of view, that's secret sauce. That's kind of what I've always enjoyed doing, building things from scratch or developing things. And so now when I'm looking at motorsports, for example, this is a very relevant example. Everything I've learned through soccer and football and through music, whatever it is, I can apply those things to motorsports. And to some people in that world, it might be innovative. It's maybe not. But at the same time, it's like being able to level teams up, level teams of people up, level brands up, whatever it is. That to me is valuable, pulling on these threads, having this wide base of inspiration and knowledge and experience, and being able to pull from the pool and apply it to different things as needed. I think that is something I'm very passionate about, and something that I think I found success in my career. You know, when I start to think about everything I blend and where my Venn diagrams overlap, England and America overlap, English sports and American sports overlap, music, soccer, esports, gaming, motorsports, those, all those circles over, like being able to blend all of this, like diversity of experience and background, travel, upbringing, interests, what have you, like, as soon as you start doing that, I mean, isn't that the sort of like the meaning of life in some regard? Like if you start to get really big with it, that's like the pursuit of, we go, and it goes full circle to what we're talking about at the very beginning, which is working on things that you're passionate about. If you do that and you bring all these things together, you create this sort of your own little personal universe for you to exist in. And you never really get, maybe you have like rent stresses and stuff, but you're still working in these bubbles and spaces that you care about and you find rewarding because they're a manifestation of everything you've ever experienced or been through or been involved in. So
a full circle moment feels like the most organic point to wrap this up, but I've just got two questions before we do. Also, I just personally took a lot of value from what you just said there. And before I do ask these questions, I've often wondered if moving about as I have through my work in life is a detriment to what I would like to do next. But hearing that take, in that it can be seen as a strength, is quite reassuring. So thanks for that.
I absolutely, like, if there's anything I can say with the utmost passion, it's that what you just said exactly, like, there is strength in the diversity, and there's strength in every form of diversity, but specifically like diversity of journey, of your journey. Like, I never think that experiencing different things is a bad thing. I love hearing about people who go from like finance to design or whatever, what have you, because that to me is, I mean, it's not only brave, but it's also just, it brings a new perspective to an arena that hasn't had it before. And I think the world just needs more of that. And I think we as humans, it can only benefit us as well. So yeah, I think that to me is a headline of what everything we've talked about, what you just said. I think there is strength in that for sure.
I think we've got our first reel right there for the promo of this episode.
Yeah, there we go.
So two questions to close up. Touching on the car, touching on the Datsun that you've just bought, and your enjoyment of building things, sometimes, you know, not necessarily physically, more in a metaphorical sense in terms of brands and in the creative sense, but in terms of the car, does the increased understanding of how that works increase the aesthetic beauty that you already appreciate.
Yes. I think I could happily look at it parked up. And this is the reason I bought it to some degree. I could look at it parked up and appreciate the object without even opening the bonnet, the hood. Like, I can just see it as a thing and love it. And that's why I got this car, because I love that silhouette, right? That's why I like a lot of cars, because they're just, whether it's like old Porsches or whatever, it's just this perfect object of design, in the same way of like a piece of art in a museum. It's the same thing to me. There's no difference. But there is a skeleton to it, an engine and a drive shaft and all of these different components that make it, as opposed to just being form, there is function there too. And it is kind of a blend of both. And so, yes, I can appreciate the form, but when you start to like remove the shell and you see the function of how this actual function is encapsulated within this form, there is a second layer to that for sure. And I will say the form is something I get. I can kind of understand and appreciate very quickly. Like, it just lands. The function, you ask me how a drive shaft works, I'm going on ChatGPT and asking a question, because I don't fully know all of these things. I never had, not to get depressive for a moment, I never had a dad who pulled an engine apart with me, right? No one in my family did that with me. So, you know, that's a very sort of like bad Hollywood stereotype of like father shows son. It's not always that way, but
cigarettes tucked in his t-shirt sleeve kind of thing.
Exactly. I never had that. But I do think that understanding how things work sort of ladder up to appreciating the beauty. The car is a very expensive and much larger version of that for me. But, you know, it on a smaller scale, knowing how a camera takes photographs, knowing how film develop, like a negative develops film, I don't need to develop my own negatives to get full beauty from it. A lot of people do. I don't. But knowing how these things work, you know, I don't know. I'm just looking around my apartment and just thinking about some of the stuff in here. I don't care how my fridge and freezer works. I probably, you know, it doesn't bother me, but there is a bit of a blend of these two things. And I've, you know, that probably goes back to having a computer far too young in my bedroom from my grandparents not having a clue what they were opening me up to with the internet in the late 90s. You know, I think that was like tinkering under early internet and like having my own computer, and that kind of just kind of opens you up to a world that you have to figure out how things work. I don't really care about getting my hands dirty in that car too much. Like, I'm not like the kind of person, car owner, who's going to want to like blow the whole thing apart myself and fix it piece nut by bolt, but I'll do a little bit, and then I'll take it to somebody who's an expert and sit alongside them for a few minutes and kind of get the knowledge and appreciate the knowledge and the engineering and the creativity involved in it. So I think you can take that, you can probably morph that into an analogy about life as well. I think there's some beauty about how things work. Wow, I feel like I could just probably boil now I'm speaking out loud. I think I could probably boil my life down to form and function. Like, that's a good tagline for me. I think I've focused a lot in the past consciously on form, but I think that it's always sort of been built on the backbone of function. You don't ever see the function quite often. Like, if the form is done well, the function takes care of itself. But yeah, wow. I'm having that revelation now. I think there is genuinely a bit of a relationship there that I haven't considered, especially when it comes to artistry, or when it comes to outlet, or even when it comes to career, for sure. You know, the final product, whether it's a creative project listed, that's the form, and the function it's serving behind the scenes, you know, that's the thing that you really spend the time developing. So yeah, kind of fascinating, actually. Yeah. Kind of interesting to dissect the two.
It's interesting that we got there from a Datsun and we've ended up there kind of encapsulating your career in that.
Well, the money I spent on that car, I hope I'm going to get something from it as opposed to more bills. So, you know, maybe after we finish, I'll take it out to go get coffee or something.
Okay, last question. This is just out of curiosity more than anything. The collection of slides of your granddad's life that are sitting boxed up there. Mm-hmm. Are there the seeds of a creative project sat within that box?
I think you were born for this job just because you are a mind reader. So I think that's probably...
My ego, you know, loves those kind of comments. So we'll keep that in.
Yeah. Yeah, do it, please. No, but genuinely... also, I think that is an interesting thing because you interview a lot of creatives. And I actually don't know anything about your story, which maybe you should interview yourself for an episode. But I think that's the kind of question that only somebody who has an understanding, well, empathy from the human that you're talking to. But also, I think that you asking that question shows that there is, your brain operates like a creative person, right? So I think not many people would ask that. And it's something I've thought about for a long time. This branch of my family moved to Penrith in the 1800s, and we bought a shoe shop called Todd's in the 1870s, I think it was, on Middlegate in Penrith, and which is like the main throughfare of the market town. We eventually renamed it McVitie's. And I think it was great-great-granddad, then my great-granddad, and then my granddad all owned it. My granddad retired and sold the shop in 1994. But when his dad died, he got left a bit of money just from the shop. Like, I don't think it was that much. It was like a good amount, but like, you know, we grew up in a town of 12,000 people. It's not like he's a rich guy by any means. We lived in a very small house, you know, lower working class. I don't know what you call that, lower working class, whatever. But he used his money, responsibly or not, but probably quite irresponsibly, on travel. But that was his version of the car. That was his version of whatever. And he loved walking. He loved travel. He loved these things. I remember the story. He was one of the first people after, maybe it was during World War II. Or, no, I think it was just after World War II, to like leave the country. He went on an expedition to Spain, to Franco's like controlled Spain, which is crazy to think about. He was in the newspapers for it. This was right after he was in the Air Force, I think it was. There's a few different things, but he did all these little things, and he went to all these places, and yeah, he took all these photographs. And I'm not presumptuous enough. I've seen like 10 of them. I'm not presumptuous enough to think that he's like a Vivian Mayer, if you know who that is, the street photographer that whose photos were just discovered in an attic like after 50 years. But, you know, the personal family version of Vivian Mayer, right? And I think I would love to, whenever I'm able to, get these slides photographed. I don't know what the project necessarily is, but the first thing that came to mind a few years ago was just an Instagram account where I just post them, you know, and just share them. His name was Ronald Ian McVitie, R.I. McVitie.
My dad's name was Ronald.
And I thought about, yeah, it's such a, he was born in the 20s, so it's like definitely a name of the times. But he went by Ian most of his life, but you know, that was technically his middle name. And I thought about starting like an R.I. McVitie collection Instagram thing, right? And just post a picture on there that I find interesting from all these places. You know, he went to all these like places all over the world I've never been to. So that was the manifestation, the creative project from this. And it's just one of those things that it's doing something with an interest, like something born at, it's like family. I have an interest in photos. And I'm a creative person. How can I put these things together? Talking about Venn diagram again, how can those circles overlap to create something from it? Who knows? We'll find out. But that's sort of it's on the to-do list whenever I get around to it, I think. There's so many photographs. It's overwhelming. You know, I have all of the old invoices from the shop going back to like 1911. I bought archival boxes and sheets to preserve them in. And there's probably 1,000, 2,000 of them, individual pieces of paper, stored them all away in archival boxes. My granddad passed during COVID. It was like, they were just going to go out. They were just going to get thrown away. And I think because I missed a big chunk of like family generational history, being an only child and not having parents around and growing up my grandparents, there's some level of connection to the past that a lot of people my age didn't have. I remember going to my granddad's friend's house and we're trying on World War One gas masks that he had still, because it was like, I just skipped a generation and this guy was born in around that time. So there's all these things that I feel like I connected to when I was younger, and experiences that I feel simultaneously older than I am, but also much younger than I am. It's a very weird feeling. I actually feel that daily, like as I navigate, and especially also being a Brit in America, just the cultural things that I was brought up on at boarding school in England versus the sort of loudness of America, that, you know, not in a slight by any means, I love being here, but there's just all of these like life navigational things that I experience daily. So like these slides, they feel like a connection for me. And how can I blend that with something that I can do and I know, and just like experience a life that parts of a life that I never talked about or got to experience. It's kind of a nice parting gift in a lot of ways. Yeah. You know, it's like it's a nice thing to have. If I don't have his, if I don't have him around, at least I've got stuff he made. I always say in a very, and I don't mean this in a sad way at all, but handwriting of people who have passed is like the amazing thing. No one ever, I never had anyone really to talk to about that before. I've mentioned it a few times, but I find my grandma's, she died like 20 years ago. I find notes in his stuff of her handwriting. And it's like this, it's literally like ink that she put on a page that's still there. It's not like a Google Doc of like a pixel. It's a physical thing that she moved to put on a thing, on a page, or he did. And it's such a personal version of that person. It's closer to me than a photograph is, handwriting. It's like a photograph is sort of this like abstract thing they had no control of. It's a capture. Mm. That's a John Berger. For anyone who's read Ways of Seeing by John Berger, that's like a good art history nerdy thing. But
it's on my to-do list.
Yeah, it's a good book. It's very like art school book, but it's good. But like handwriting is a very personal thing. And so when I start thinking about the slides as well, there's just some, yeah, it's like a thing, like you don't have to let go of the past. Like that, it's a nice connection, but also like a good memory. I have all of these little artifacts from my family and from where I grew up. And the older I get, the more I feel connected. So like people listening to audio only can't see this, but this is like a piece of paper, a letterhead. Shake it so you can hear the paper. That is like, it's got McVitie's Family Footwear Specialist, the address of the shop we used to own on it. And I have thousands of these that were unused. This is so old that it has like a 4-digit area code on it from England, which is now 5. But it's like these things, artifacts, things to, and I'll give you another full circle moment to wrap it up. But if I think about me walking away in the airport without looking back to go to America for the first time at 7 years old, I can now, as a mid-30s human being who's moved halfway across the world, I am looking back and I am like seeing these things, whether it's slides or handwriting or invoices from the shop or pieces of paper with letterhead that my granddad would write on, whatever it is, all these things, or even wanting to come home and visit Penrith and work with the football team in Penrith. I would love to do that at some point to keep a family connection to the town. I am looking back and I am finding real, reward, value. I'm not quite sure what the word would be, but I'm finding genuine fulfillment in connection with where I grew up. And it only took moving halfway around the world to get to that point. So, and decades, but you know, it's, that's the journey of life, I suppose. And it's, you know, through wherever I work, whatever team I work for, whatever project I work on, I think the sort of expansion of self through things that interest you personally or professionally seems like a theme on this podcast, but also I think it's a very big theme in my life too, that finding those moments and those things and artifacts and projects and what have you that make you feel alive and holding on to them, holding them close, is the thing that gets you through every day and gets you through life, I guess, you know, in a, not in a sad way either, just in like in a rewarding, personal way. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's the journey of life, you know, it's quite, for me, quite on the nose, just given how far away I am from where I was born. So, you know, all those pieces of connection that I try and manifest and connect back to, things I work on and places I visit, I think it is a representation of that journey and where I want to go and where I've come from. So, yeah.
I think you've just done a fantastic job of wrapping this up in the neatest of bows. And over the back quarter of the year, I began to label this podcast as the football podcast that's not about football. And if any conversation encapsulates that, it's this one.
We didn't even talk about places I've worked. I didn't give you the sort of like traditional business Zoom call background story, companies and such. So
they go where, you know, they go. These maybe you don't need that. They go where they go. And I think that's the beauty of it. And I
can copy paste my CV for you and yeah, you can put it in the podcast notes, yeah, and then you can get it that way.
For anyone that wants those blanks filled in, they can just scroll down to the podcast notes.
Absolutely. And I will say, just to talk about this podcast for a second, the people that you've had on it are amazing. Like everybody you've had on here, it's a who's who of people I value and care about, and a lot of people I regard as friends too. If I don't know them personally, I've come across them. And if I haven't come across them, I'm shocked that I've gone and followed them, right? Because I don't think that you could have an outlet like the one that you have. I don't think you could have an outlet that has a better selection of people that talk to the sort of modern game or business around the game or good, you know, whatever it is, whether it's Ted or Dan Coben or Pete Martin or Naomi, whoever it is, like it is a Hollywood Walk of Fame list to some degree of people, you know, in different sizes, different locations. And it is a privilege to be among them, because I sort of float and do my own thing, I feel like, quite a lot of the time, but I'm in esteemed company and I feel very privileged to be a part of it. But it is a reflection of how good of a job you're doing, and the taste and the stories you get from those people, it's so valuable. I don't know of anywhere else that has that good cross-section of folks in one place. So I mean, keep doing what you're doing. Yeah, that's kudos to you for assembling such an amazing list of folks.
I really appreciate you saying that, mate. And yeah, that does kind of, I guess, tally up with what I get from it, from having these conversations. And yeah, I'm really glad that we got to have this chat. I mean, I had a feeling it would be a good one from the initial back and forth.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. I really do appreciate the time. You've been generous with it.
Anytime. I think just talking about, whenever you talk about life, you get good stuff. So I think, you know, framing it within something that we're all passionate about only leads to even better things, you know, football and creativity and everything else. So
nice one.
Yeah, I'm excited to see who you get on next.
There's some good ones coming.
Maybe get yourself on.
Yeah, I'll just have to rig up a mirror just to kind of get the format going. See if I can look myself in the eye. Who knows? Yeah. Nice one, Nathan. Mate, I'll let you get on with your day over there. I'm 40 now, so I'm going to be going to bed in about half an hour.
I'm not that far behind you. I might go have another coffee. I'll take the car out or something. You've inspired me to start it.
If you do, I'd like to see it in situ. Please let me know.
Yeah, I'll get some photos. And you should get yourself over here to California too. Maybe you can do a little podcast on the road and get some folks.
Mate, that's an easy sell.
On location.
I don't have to twist my arm too much for that one.
Brand sponsors, you know?
Here we go. Nice one, mate. I'll leave you to it.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Don't forget to hit the follow button, and I'll see you next time.